Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Seriously Risky Business Podcast, the podcast that Tom Uren and I do, which is mostly geared towards people who work in government and policy, and is based on the weekly Seriously Risky Business newsletter that Tom Uren writes. We would like to thank the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for making this work possible, and also say thank you to our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint. Tom, let's get into it now. This week's newsletter was an absolutely cracking addition. I think the most interesting story in there was your report on moves by the US government to kind of rein in commercial spyware. The reason I say it was very interesting is we saw media coverage all over the place, but you were the one who pointed out that what these actions will do is kind of focus the intelligence community's attention on the issue of commercial spyware when previously that wasn't the case. And I think you're the only person to have analyzed and reported on this who's really made a note of the significance of that.
Yeah, well, when I first read the reports, I read some in the Washington Post and CyberScoop, and I thought, these are good wrap-ups. And I didn't know that I had all that much to say. And then I sort of thought about it a bit longer. And it occurred to me that the commercial spyware industry is something that could have slipped under the radar of the intelligence community in terms of, is this something we really care about? So those companies, NSO Group, for example, purported to just focus on criminal and counterterrorism work. And as long as they stick to that from an intelligence community point of view, it's like, well, that's great. We don't care. As long as they're sticking to that, we don't need to pay them any attention. We can ask our Israeli government contacts, is everything going well? And they'll say yes. And then we can focus on things that are really, really important. So until those spyware providers were found to be targeting US diplomats, it's like, why should we care? And there's reasons that you could be interested in them, because some of them may have capabilities that are, you know, top notch, and it'd be good to know what those are. And from a targeting point of view, who are the people and organizations that are being targeted by other governments? But compared to some other priorities that you have, I think they're fairly low down. So I think
and the one thing I want to point out, right, is you know, you can be someone who works at NSA in a senior position and be interested in this issue. You can think that it's bad that they're targeting activists, you know, that people are using NSO tools, for example, to target activists, but it's not really your wheelhouse, right? And I think that's what's interesting about what you've written here is, as part of these reforms, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, which is the office that oversees all intelligence activity, it's sort of like the interface between the government, you know, elected representatives in the intelligence community, the DNI is going to have to produce an annual report on commercial spyware activity. So all of a sudden now, while it might have been of interest to the intelligence community, you know, the IC wasn't officially tasked with actually paying attention to it, and now it is. And that's actually pretty significant.
Yeah. I think that changes it from a kind of an intellectual passing interest to a priority, like work we have to do.
I think you described it as what was a small national security problem is now a small national security problem with politics attached to it, right?
Yeah, with political priority. And I mean, ultimately, intelligence collection requirements come down to what's politically a necessity. So I compared it to China, a long-term strategic threat, and Russia and the war in Ukraine. These are obviously really high priorities, but now commercial spyware has threats to the way, the way the global system works in terms of human rights. And that is a long-term strategic priority for the United States and democracies. And I think the legislative arm has said this is important and we care about it. We should do something about it, basically.
Yeah, so it's less based on those hard criteria for national security, assessment, and more based on, well, you know, the political leadership seeing as a priority, right?
Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues too that makes it a bit of a political priority is now you can put top tier tools in the hands of, like, you know, second and third tier nations, right? And that's always been the issue with these types of tool makers.
Yeah. So I think there's a second thing going on, which is that the it's sort of become a proliferation issue. So it's not only a political priority because of the human rights and other implications for civil liberties, but it's also more of a national security threat because of the proliferation of those capabilities. So I think those two things are running together. I think until the political, the legislature sort of raised the priority, it was easy for the national security part just to fly under the radar because these groups try and operate stealthily.
Yeah, they try to avoid the attention in the first place. You also point out that there are provisions in these reforms that would allow the US government to sort of ban government contracts going to people who are doing bad things with this stuff. My favorite paragraph in the newsletter, I'm just going to read it, is these provisions essentially ask the question of the intelligence community, how much should we worry about foreign commercial spyware while in the meantime telling foreign spyware firms don't do bad stuff? And I think that's a nice succinct summary of where it's at. But I do feel like perhaps the why this is significant has kind of flown under the radar a little bit in some of the coverage.
Right. Yeah. To me, it's about the politics rather than the actual sort of facts on the ground. Even though there's an increasing proliferation risk, it still, I don't think, compares to some of the other priorities that the intelligence community faces. And if it's an all difficult target, it requires focus to get access to. It's not just something you can flick on and off with a switch. That's my take anyway.
Okay. And another thing we're going to talk about is, some more regulatory and sort of legislative action in the United States, which is it looks like they're getting close to passing what looks to be, at first glance at least, a rather sensible data protection law. As you point out in your coverage, and I missed this when I recorded yesterday's main Risky Business show, it looks like this one won't pass because a senior committee member doesn't think it goes hard enough, but it certainly looks like we're moving towards the United States actually having a data protection regime. And what makes an interesting feature of it is it's kind of doing what you've been advocating for, which is focus less on the broking of sensitive information and focus more on putting a lot of these companies in the position where they shouldn't be collecting that stuff in the first place. So it looks like a collection minimization regime, and surprisingly sensible. You know, normally you expect when a law like this gets floated in the United States, it's got lobbyists' fingerprints all over it, but this one actually looks quite good.
Yeah, I was impressed, to be honest. So I wrote about the idea of just not collecting really bad stuff in the first place a little while ago, and that was in the context of the national security threat of the data broking and ad tech ecosystem. And it just seems to me that once you've got data that could be used maliciously available, there's no way to constrain it because you can cut it and slice it and dice it, and it's very, very hard to stop things being put together in a way that makes
it's hard to unscramble
really
the omelette. There we go. Let's roll out that old tired metaphor. But yeah, it's true. It's hard to unblend the milkshake. There we go.
Yeah. So I compared just data collection, location data collection, the way that Apple does it in Maps, where they take a lot of steps to separate it from the user. They slice it up in time, so it's really hard to track an individual. And that just seems to me to be a much more sensible way to do some of those things, is to just not do them in the first place. And then it leaves what's done with the data. You feel much more comfortable that people can't do really bad, malicious things with the data after that. So that's basically what the legislation, that's one of the provisions, that you can only collect data for 17 purposes. Some of them are like, you know, anti-fraud, like just delivering the products you're selling. Now, sort of worryingly, I guess, one of the causes is for targeted advertising. So
I've seen people criticizing it for that. But what do they expect? They want Congress to nuke the entire online advertising industry. Like, I just don't feel like that's realistic.
Yeah, that's right. I agree. I think that's it's reasonable to have that in there. What you want to see is what is, and it's got to be, the law says, necessary and proportionate. So what's necessary and proportionate targeted advertising? It's probably not what some companies are doing nowadays, but it's not no targeting at all. And so I think that's fair enough. it also allows people to opt out of targeted advertising, and you're not allowed to target people under 17. And I think those two provisions alone, even without the necessary and proportionate, are a huge step forward. And I really like it in comparison to the GDPR, which starts out with nice principles, but ends up with this sort of just hellscape of clicking consent boxes.
GDPR compliance is an entire industry that didn't exist before GDPR because, it got pretty complicated pretty quick, didn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not convinced that it achieved all that much. So there is some research that citizens in the US are targeted twice as much as citizens in the EU, but that's a difference of degree rather than of not being targeted at all. So the GDPR did something, but I would argue that half as much targeting is probably not worth all the opt-out forms that people and all the compliance. And also I've seen research that innovation suffered in the EU because of it.
So and also you got to keep in mind that the US is the largest single consumer market on the planet, right? So, you know, you're going to expect to be marketed at more when you're in the biggest market.
Yeah. So my understanding is that the Maria Cantwell, the senator who's the chair of the Commerce Committee, doesn't back it because she doesn't think it's stringent enough. There's not enough penalties. So it's not that the bill is bad. It's just that it's not as strong as she'd like. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if they make the sticks a little bit bigger in the bill, she'll jump on board.
Look, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, like it's taking shape. It's shaping up in that direction. So let's see. Now, another fascinating story that you ran was about some Dutch research into a solar controller, like a solar panel controller that's used in home solar installations. And they did some security research into this thing and found that it was, like typical IoT bad. But then you actually start adding up the amount of electricity that's produced by home PV systems using these systems just in the Netherlands. I think you and I sat down with a calculator and worked out that it was more than 200 megawatts of capacity just in the Netherlands, right? And I think the coverage says something like, you know, panels managed by these devices is responsible for, what was it, 10 gigawatts or something of energy globally? Yeah. So, I mean, you've put together a pretty compelling argument that, you know, solar rooftop power is kind of distributed critical infrastructure attached to people's houses and being run with very, very insecure stuff. And maybe this is a problem, which I think is a really interesting thought.
Yeah. So I've been following the critical infrastructure legislation here, and really the entire paradigm is let's find the big pieces of infrastructure that are really, really important, owned by just a very few companies, and make sure that we deal with those very few companies and make sure that they behave properly and regulate them. Whereas this is an entirely different paradigm. And it sort of sneaks up on you because you can install a solar system on one rooftop and it makes obviously no difference at all, but no matter how good or bad the security is. But as you add more and more, it becomes more and more of a problem. So it's struck me as that kind of problem that no one recognizes until all of a sudden, for some reason, there's an outage, like, you know, maliciously or by accident, and all of a sudden a third of the rooftop panels in Australia stop working for some reason or stop contributing to the grid. And then we have, you know, hellish blackouts or something like that. So this is something that...
I mean, that's taking it to a pretty extreme extension. But I mean, where I found it interesting is just that this is a regulatory black spot, right? Like no one would have really thought about this. And I know that ACSC has done a lot of work on like IoT security and maybe trying to think about certain standards and requirements for Australia, you know, devices sold in Australia. But this is where that sort of nice to have labeling kind of does brush up against critical infrastructure a little. Like the solar system that we have on our house, you know, my household, we charge an electric car from our solar and run our household on it. And we're still a net exporter of electricity. Our household is a net exporter of electricity, and it is managed by, and I won't say the brand, but it is a large brand of solar controller that does all sorts of cloud monitoring and, you know, like live firmware pushes and things like that. And I'd imagine that this brand being so popular, you know, I can't even imagine how much electricity is pumped into the grid by systems using, you know, this particular IoT thing. And God knows how good a job they've done with securing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the question, like, God knows. And it would be good if someone else knew and decided exactly what to do about it.
That's right.
And, you know, I don't think it's the same type of regulation as critical infrastructure, but I think it's worth just thinking about and making an active decision instead of just sleepwalking into some state where it's not well thought about.
I figure the smart metering people are the ones to take this on because, you know, we have a big smart meter push in Australia, smart electricity meters, and you would think that the people who are handling the regulation and rollouts and whatnot of that stuff would be probably well positioned to at least be the ones to think about this. We might want to put it in their wheelhouse is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, cool. Now, just staying on the issue of critical infrastructure protection, the TSA in the United States pushed updated guidelines, security guidelines for oil and gas pipeline operators. This, of course, is because of the Colonial ransomware attack, which was what? Time is a blur. I have two kids. It was either last year or the year before. May last year, there you go.
Yeah.
So there was the Colonial ransomware attack, and then the TSA pushed a bunch of quite prescriptive regulations that everyone said was stupid, and now they've finally pushed new ones that people say are better. But you've got a bit of analysis here that says, okay, they might be better, but there's clearly not that much cybersecurity expertise within TSA. That will be difficult for them to spin up. And also, there's not much cybersecurity expertise within the pipeline industry, so it will be difficult to bring people meaningfully in compliance with any sort of standards laid down by the TSA anyway. So not exactly a good, you know, not exactly a happy analysis there, Tom.
No. So it was interesting to sort of try and dig deeper. And I think the fact that the initial legislation was flawed reflected a lack of expertise at the regulator. So a lot of initial coverage was that, look, it's great that the regulator listened to industry and so we've got something better. But the underlying thing is just the lack of expertise, which is still a problem and continues to be a problem. So I spoke to Patrick Miller, who was a former electricity regulator, and he's, you know, basically there's not enough expertise. His view was that setting a good standard is less than half the battle. And what's also really important is monitoring how firms are doing meeting that regulation and ensuring that they continue to meet it over time. So he actually said that, you know, I'd much rather have an okay or crappy or even bad regulation with a good regulator who knows how to audit and check that things are up to scratch rather than have a good regulation with poor auditing.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that was the quote that I would have absolutely brought out because, yeah, he said it doesn't matter if the regulation sucks if the regulator's good. But in this case, you know, they're not.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the view there is that as time goes on, if you've got a good regulator, you can see what's working and see what's not working and you can improve the standard over time. Whereas if you've got no idea, it's really hard to make improvements.
Yeah.
So his view was that some of the original regulation just really illustrated that lack of expertise. The example he gave was a requirement to change passwords on PLCs, programmable logic controllers. And he said that many of the PLCs are geographically distributed and you have to, so all along the length of a pipeline, and they don't have administrative access remotely. They don't have remote administrative access. You actually have to drive up, connect to the PLC to change the password.
Yeah.
And he said that the timelines for doing that were 30 days. And he said there just weren't enough people, even though that's not a highly skilled job, to do that in that time. Plus, you weren't actually achieving anything by changing those passwords because they weren't remotely accessible anyway.
Yeah, it's amazing when you realize, you know, and I don't know if it's the case with pipeline infrastructure, but you ever sit next to someone on a plane and just have a really interesting conversation? I remember like 10, 15 years ago, I wound up sitting next to a guy who was a linesman. It was his job to maintain power infrastructure in this area. And a lot of listeners would know, but I don't live anywhere near a city. I live in a regional area. And he was telling me about all of the crazy hillbillies who grow pot And when you turn up to like fix the power pole, they think that you're there as part of some, you know, sting operation for the drug squad. And so you have to, you know, that's one thing to manage. But, you know, other places where they're so difficult to access, you're basically out there with a backpack full of food and a machete just to get to the thing. And then if there's a new pole that needs to come in, they need to chopper it in. Anyway, fascinating conversation I had with a with a linesman working in the backwoods of the Northern Rivers. So that was great. But look, anyone who wants to check out the newsletter, head to risky.biz/subscribe. The newsletter is called Seriously Risky Business. And it's weekly. And yeah, it was a fascinating read this week, Tom. So well done.
Thanks.
On that. But we're going to introduce a section that I'm jokingly going to call right now Between Two Nerds, because it's you and Gruck. We published a conversation between you and Gruck, the Gruck, last week that was very, very interesting. But you guys love talking about niches within niches within niches. And you spoke to him about how, if you want to be good at cyber operations, we often hear that people say that, you know, SIGINT agencies are too bureaucratic and they can't be agile. But you had this conversation with him where you're pointing out that if you want to be a cyber superpower, you need a good bureaucracy, because that enables decision makers to be able to move everyone in the same direction very, very quickly. How did I go summarizing that?
What I would say is that you need bureaucracy to harness the different talents you need to have an effective, to be a cyber superpower, for lack of a better term. And it's really getting hundreds or thousands of people working together for a common goal that creates the ability to have, you know, really effective cyber operations.
Yeah, so I'm going to drop it in here where the Gruck is explaining why bureaucracy is a magical superpower, and that'll be it. So that interview runs for about 10 minutes, and that'll be it for this week's podcast edition of Seriously Risky Business. Tom Uren, thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Bureaucracy is a superpower. You sort of, as soon as you understand what it gives you, it makes sense to talk of it that way. So the sort of the classic signs of bureaucracy are that there's a sort of hierarchy, this division of labor, that units do their sort of own thing, that there's rules, like bureaucracies are about rules, and they're about executing it sort of impersonally. Like the idea is that it's a meritocracy. You don't have someone in charge just because they're someone's nephew, but because they have managerial experience and can run a shop of five people. So these sort of things come together. And then because there's these rules that allow you to execute impersonally, it allows you to sort of build up and scale. And it allows you to do things everywhere the same way. And that becomes incredibly useful when, for example, you need to, marshal the entire resources of a state. Like, you can't do that based on, you know, friendship. You can't be like, you know, the president calls his mates who call out and say, okay, you know, everyone go and meet the people that they know and try and get some tax for the, you know, the state. Like, that's not going to work.
Yeah. Friend relationships and tribal relationships only get you so far. One of the things I think it really brings is also the ability to bring different skills together on the same problem, which is what I think is really important for the cybersecurity, or I guess cyber espionage particularly.
Yeah. Basically, when there is bureaucracy, it can either sort of hinder how operations are done, because maybe you have a rule that says this needs to get legal sign-off, and so you can't do any operation without a lawyer having looked at it, which means if that lawyer decides, you know, well, it depends, and then it sort of gets kicked through that, you might never actually run your op. But on, but on the other hand, it can mean that when there is serious interest in getting something done, those resources that are necessary will be made available, because it will go to someone within this organization who can say, okay, look, we need, we need 10 people doing blog posting. We need 10 people on, you know, writing phishing emails. We need that O'Day guy, and we need him now, you know, and they can sort of just bring that together and make it happen. And
So last week we were talking about the intelligence cycle, and I think this is a good example of the bureaucracy and the intelligence cycle are kind of interrelated, in that the intelligence cycle covers things like setting priorities, collection and exploitation, analysis and dissemination. And each of those functions, and you mentioned lawyers, so like compliance is also a function. And those are all specialist functions. Like you can't have your exploit dev also doing compliance and production. They're just people, they're just not like that, or very, very, very few people. And so when it comes to having those functions work together, you need bureaucracy in a positive sense of the word. And when that comes to priorities, there's many, many things that are not super high priority, and they tend to get delayed or work through the fabric of bureaucracy at a regular pace, which is not very fast. And what you need to cut through, like you said, is high priority, something that someone at the top really cares about. You spoke last week about the Russians and... Yes, exactly. So tell us a little bit about that, and let's sort of explore how that relates to priorities and bureaucracy.
Yeah, so I think Gucci for Two is an excellent example of how a state intelligence agency can operate very fast in sort of times of crisis and the ways that that falls apart. So the story is, this is, you know, 2016, Washington Post has just published an article saying the Russians have hacked the DNC, the Democrats, and stolen a whole bunch of stuff. And this is the first time the Russians hear about it. They've been completely burned. Their whole, like, we're going to be, you know, secretly releasing this stuff, it's gone, right? Like, that entire operation should be destroyed. They've been cut off and exposed. This should be a disaster. So within 24 hours, they've turned it around and not only saved their operation, but created another one that is to this day still ongoing. And the way that they did that was they drew up a list of reporters. They went through the stuff that they had, you know, whatever they'd stolen. They created this attribution front, a skeleton called Gucci for Two. So this attribution front is, you know, the front, as we would say, like it doesn't exist. It's just a thing. And as an attribution front, it's there only to claim attribution for having done a thing.
Yeah. It was me, sir.
Exactly. Right. And that's literally what they do, is they email these reporters with a bunch of documents. They put up they create a blog post that says, it was me, I'm not a Russian, I guarantee you, you know, I'm a Romanian or whatever. And they chose Guccifer because Guccifer had just been in the news about a month earlier saying something about Hillary Clinton. So it was thematically connected. And when they sent this thing out, these reporters, they took it hook, line, and sinker. They were just like, hey, you know, it might have been the Russians, but here we have this Guccifer 2 guy who says that he did it, and he says he's not Russian, so it could be anyone.
Right? Yep.
But then if you looked at the documents, there were, you know, all of these artifacts left behind that showed that it was processed on multiple machines. Some of them had, like, embedded names of the users that were logged in. One of them was Iron Felix. If you don't know, Iron Felix is the nickname of the guy who founded the Cheka, which is the original KGB.
Right, yeah. That's Dudzinski or something like that.
Yeah,
that
yeah. Right? I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
So we were talking about... I don't know either. So we were talking about this, and it's an example of an organization, and a big organization, presumably, the Russian military intelligence, pivoting. And my comment was that makes me think it was a really high priority operation, because the way that you get things done in a bureaucracy is you have priority. And this kind of makes sense in retrospect. The intelligence community, the US intelligence community, says that they believe Putin authorized the interference with the election. So people really, really cared. And I've sort of my experience is that in those organizations, there's perhaps one or two or three things that the very top guy can actually care about. And you can do tremendously well when it's you're working on one of those top three things. And that's when, you know, the lawyer who's got to decide, is this operation legal, has like 5 or 10 minutes to make up their mind. And everyone else just piles on behind it, and there's no stoppages. And that's when you get that multidisciplinary breaking up of skills and coming together to work on a single operation.
As I said, like the hallmark of bureaucracy is sort of rules. Like that's the things that bureaucracies are good at. And that's one of the problems, of course, like the red tape, and it's, you know, it's caught up in bureaucracy. But it's also one of the good things, because the trick with rules is they're interpreted by human beings. So the interpretation of the rule matters as much as the rule itself. So when something's high priority, you know, it might be a rule that only the thing on the top of the stack gets processed. But if something is a high priority, it won't be put on the bottom of the stack. The guy's just going to put it straight to the top, so it gets processed first. You know, like they will adjust the rules as necessary to make sure that things go the way that they're supposed to go. It's about this division of labor, where you have like specialists doing their specialist thing. Yeah. And, you know, when you have a way of bringing that together with, you know, organization.
Thanks again, Gruck, for a wonderful chat. And let's do it all again next week.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Good to speak to you.